Hi, my name is Johnny Gartner, and welcome back to the Cedar 60 podcast. At Cedar 60, our mission is to engage with culture and politics from the distinctive lens of the gospel. Today, we're excited to have Dr. Christine Roanson join us on the podcast as we discuss advancing technology and slow-moving public policy. Dr. Rosen, thank you so much for joining us this morning. We really appreciate it.
Thanks for having me on.
Absolutely. So if you could just briefly introduce yourself to our listeners, there might be some people who have listened to some of your other podcasts before, but if you just want to introduce your work, we really appreciate having you on.
Sure. I'm a senior fellow at the American Enterprise Institute, Research Institute in Washington, D.C. I'm also one of the co-hosts of the Commentary Magazine Daily podcast, where I spend most of my time trying to interrupt my colleagues and occasionally succeeding. I am a contributing columnist to Commentary Magazine as well. I contributor to National Review. And I also have an affiliation at the Institute for Advanced Studies in Culture at the University of Virginia, where I continue some of my historical and ethical research into the history of technology.
So if you could kind of briefly introduce us to what got you started on this like area of study, I think it's pretty fascinating.
Sure. I have a very strange path to my current work. I actually went to undergraduate the University of South Florida. I was born and raised in Florida. And I went to college on a bassoon scholarship. Yes, bassoon. look it up. One of the weirdest woodwind instruments of all time. I loved it. It was a wonderful opportunity. Paid my way through college. But I was a history major. Did history and political science minor. And I really fell in love with history, and particularly the history of science and technology. So I went on to graduate school at Emory University. I got my PhD at the history department there. And my focus of my research was on a period of time, late 19th, early 20th century United States progressive movement, and in particular, how Protestant, Catholic, and Jewish leaders dealt with the many seismic shifts in the culture that were brought on by scientific discovery, by public policy that wanted to use so-called science to implement its goals, and just the way that people of faith and leaders of faith in particular navigated that very tumultuous time. And at a time when I think there was a cliche that science and religion were always at war, in fact, they weren't. There were a lot of attempts at accommodation on both sides, some of which were useful, some of which were terrible. So I ended up writing about the history of the eugenics movement, the people who wanted to improve the human race through better breeding. And from there, went to Washington, started working at research institutes and think tanks, and a group of friends and I was at the time at the Ethics and Public Policy Center, started a journal called The New Atlantis. And there I branched out into more contemporary technology, whether the way that it was changing our behavior, why cell phones made us a little more rude in public space. And this was very early, like pre-social media. I mean, really the dinosaur age for personal technology. Everyone had a brick or a flip phone at the time. But I noticed that socially and culturally, it was really transforming how we interacted. So luckily, my pals at the New Atlantis were happy to let me kind of run wild with essays on a range of subjects, social media, online dating, cell phone use. I wrote about plastic surgery. Just anything that I found kind of fascinating, I was able to write about. I also wrote a lot about reproductive technologies and the sort of ethical issues around our new reproductive technology. So from there, I ended up, you know, went to a couple different think tanks, some left of center, some right of center, and I'm very happily ensconced now at the American Enterprise Institute, where I have a lot of old friends, and it's a wonderful place that really encourages free expression and debate. And as you know, Johnny, because you've done some of the programs for college students there, we really are we really try to reach out outside of the Beltway with the work that our scholars are doing. So it's a very happy home for me.
Yeah. A small plug for AEI is not unwelcome. AEI is a great institution, and I can encourage any of our listeners to go check them out, including your work with AEI as well.
Thank you.
This is kind of a loaded question, but if you could just briefly, you kind of hinted at it, but how has technology really redefined what it means to be a human being?
It's a very good question. We could probably spend about 6 months of podcasting and never get to a definitive answer, but I'll take a stab at it. I'm finishing up a book manuscript now that tries to get at some of these questions. And I would say the main challenge as human beings when we create something that makes our lives more efficient or connects us in new ways is always a kind of hopeful enthusiasm that finally we found a tool that will make us better people. The conceit, of course, is that often a lot of these tools end up either inadvertently or by design exacerbating aspects of human nature that we've since time began struggled with as human beings. So the main thing I think our current technologies have changed about what it means to be human is that it has allowed us to indulge far too much in the conceit that we aren't physical human beings ensouled in bodies that have limits, and that limits are actually useful, necessary, and important, particularly when we start thinking about a moral life. How do you lead a good moral life? How do you flourish as a human being? Our technologies promise to give us a pathway towards human flourishing, and in many cases, they help us reach that. But they are a means, not an end, and I think we often mistake them for ends in themselves, and that way lies danger.
Yeah, you've kind of hinted at some of the technologies in the past or currently that are kind of threatening that line. Could you talk about maybe just a couple specific technologies that you might be looking at right now that really kind of are bordering that line of like we're trying to exceed our limits or that are, you know, really morally questionable?
Sure. Let's see. Off the top of my head, I'll give you two. There's one I wrote about almost 20 years ago now, artificial womb technology, again, developed to help people who could not sustain a pregnancy in their body. The idea of being able to allow children to thrive outside a mother's womb using a artificial technology to keep them alive. That was always sort of a weird science fiction idea, right? That was a staple of science fiction, in fact. And I wrote about it at a time when they were making some pretty serious advances, a lot of experiments on animals that were yielding success. But the idea and the impulse behind this effort to create artificial wombs from the practitioners and the scientists who were researching it was we want to help sustain human life. We want to give people who might otherwise lose a child an opportunity for that child to live. A very good impulse. Of course, the creation of that technology is not itself a morally neutral tool, right? Because there were just as many people who said, in fact, I spoke to a few radical feminists who are like, this is great. Women don't have to get pregnant anymore. We will finally be equal to men. We'll just outsource that and we don't have to use surrogates or anything. We'll just pop them in the incubator and be done with it. So I really wanted to explore why that made me uneasy. What was it about giving birth? And this, it was interesting because I wrote this right after having my own children. And I think I was very influenced by the experience of pregnancy in the sense that there's something about that. We are designed to have children this way. And tinkering with that process to save life, I think, is a worthwhile goal. And we have what we've been able to do for prematurely born infants is incredible. I have friends who are NICU nurses who work in those wards. It's a calling. It's amazing the work they do. But the idea of getting to a point where we can outsource childbirth, that is a different whole kettle of fish. So there's a new book coming out in the UK, it should probably come out here soon, called Eve, which is exploring how we've advanced that even more. And I think we're going to see in the years to come many more people making a moral case for why this is an important technology to embrace and mainstream. I would argue it's not. I think that there is something unique about being born of a human being. It is part of what makes us special and distinct from animals. It is a process that, again, it's difficult to quantify why we feel that way. And it's very easy to just reject that as some sort of superstition or some religious superstition, which is one of the things I heard brought up by some of the people who want to advance this. But I do think we're going to have to grapple with that because, the impulse for the technology of an artificial womb is to save more lives and to allow people who might not otherwise be able to have children to have them. I don't think anyone would argue with that as an impulse. The problem is that once you create that opening, where does it go from there? And how do we, at the very beginning, start to talk about ethical safeguards that need to be put in place from the very beginning? These are the questions we faced with cloning. We face this with reproductive genetic technologies like pre-implantation genetic diagnosis. Do we only do it for fatal diseases or do we allow sex selection? So there's a whole world of very gray ethical areas. And in the United States in particular, we don't have a lot of regulation.
Yeah.
We have a free market in these technologies and other countries, the UK in particular, do not. So we have to start talking about, and again, as conservatives, not an easy conversation for me. I tend to be skeptical of government regulation, but the question is whether we need to start thinking through some safeguards and what those would look like. Yeah.
You've hinted at this next question perfectly. Conservatives really balk at regulation, and oftentimes for good reason. I heard a joke once. It was, "What if the opposite of pro is con? What's the opposite of progress?" And the answer is Congress.
I like that one.
Yeah,
particularly our current Congress. Yeah.
Yeah. So there's a lot of failure of Congress to even just begin talking about some of these things, just because of how messy it gets. And you've kind of hinted at why it's worthwhile, but what does getting into regulation of these issues look like in American politics?
It looks like a mess, I think, but for a number of reasons. To go back in time a little bit and think about under George W. Bush, we had a President's Commission on Bioethics. Dr. Leon Cass headed that commission. And one of the things he did, which I think was really brilliant and necessary and that we need to think about repeating, is at a moment when a lot of these technologies were coming to market, he convened not just scientists and not just bureaucrats, he convened philosophers, historians, ethicists, religious leaders around a single table and held a series of sessions where, there were testimony from people from all along, from industry, from government. And he tried to get a conversation going that really looked at the complicated number of issues at play. But in that conversation, ethics, faith, these things were central as well. It wasn't just, we'll cover that later in a footnote. It was central to the project of thinking through whether these were tools that we should embrace as citizens. That was really important. He was lambasted in the mainstream media as like a right-wing reactionary, all this other stuff. But I think it was really useful to do that, because that is what you need to do before you can even start talking about regulation, right? The public doesn't really have the time or the inclination to dive deeply into a lot of these subjects. So what public hearings and public commissions and who issue reports, he issued a series of reports, which I highly recommend. They're all online. You can go find them and read them. Fascinating documents that speak to a lot of the issues around human cloning and reproductive technology. We need to have those conversations first, because our lawmakers need to hear from the people who elected them as to their sensibility for this. So let's take an example of sex selection technology, for example. So this is now, you can do this, right? There are no real industry standards. This is another thing, is that the reproductive technology industry governs itself. They have reached kind of consensus on a few things. So for example, it used to be, if you did IVF, there were doctors that would implant lots of embryos in a woman, hoping, someone stick, but it did lead to an increase in multiple pregnancies, which are higher risk for the women and the children. So they came to a consensus that was like, if a woman's healthy, we're going to just implant one embryo and hope it takes. So to kind of get ahead of this trend of multiples and the health risk that they pose. Fine. But there wasn't a law that made them do that. And you can argue whether there should or should not be. They haven't done that with a lot of the pre-implantation genetic diagnosis stuff and the sex selection technology. So that's a role for, I think, federal oversight of an industry. And the fertility industry is massive. It makes a lot of money. It helps a lot of people, but it doesn't have a lot of government oversight. We tend to see it when something goes wrong, when an embryo switched in a clinic, when there's some sort of lawsuit. So we've been kind of regulating it after the fact using the court system. And I don't think, given the power of some of these new technologies, particularly the ones that can, CRISPR, that can snip sections of DNA and do all kinds of, that stuff is much more order of magnitude powerful than what came before. And that really is begging for public analysis and perhaps future government regulation.
I think about the battle that's happening with social media regulation right now, super controversial, and legislators are really slow to move on any kind of regulation on the industry. So what do you think needs to happen for regulators to kind of get on this board, to start making these reports, doing these kinds of investigations, to get regulation jump-started in Congress?
So we need political leadership. I mean, one of the reasons the social media regulation stuff is in the news is that some of us have been screaming this from the rooftops for more than a decade. I am one of those people who's like, as soon as Facebook arrived, I'm like, they set that limit at 13 for when kids can get on it. And you know that 9 and 10 year olds are going to be on that next week. And sure enough, because they're not enforcing, they have no incentive to enforce their own guidelines. The age of 13, by the way, was a compromise position on the Children's Online Privacy Protection Act, piece of legislation that was brought into being before social media existed, and that initially was going to set that limit for age 16. I happen to think that 16 is a more reasonable limit to place on access to these platforms, given that they are designed for adults and given what we now know about their impact on mental health. But what brought that to Congress's attention finally was you started to have more of a bipartisan agreement on potential harms. Before that, if you recall, well, actually you can't recall, you're too young to recall, but you know, the Democratic Party really embraced social media. You know, this was like Obama was the Facebook president. There was a lot of praise for how politicians were using these tools to reach people because and help get themselves elected. There wasn't a lot of skepticism. There was a huge amount of money flowing from Silicon Valley companies into the coffers of Democratic Party candidates. And that still remains the effect. They give as well to Republicans, but the employees of these companies and the companies themselves give a lot more money to Democrats. So there was a kind of uneasy detente about regulation. And there was also in there, of course, all my libertarian friends, they always yell at me for this, but there was a libertarian argument for just keep your hands off it. Anything goes, you know, the government shouldn't be involved in this at all. So that's changing and it's still in flux. You have senators like Josh Hawley who proposed, you know, legislation that would set an age limit of 16 for social media. But that started with scholars and researchers and the public asking the right questions. So we started saying, asking those questions, looking to evidence. So wonderful behavioral social scientist, social psychologist Jonathan Haidt has been looking at social media and its impact for years. A number of other scholars as well, because there's competing evidence. So Facebook will hold up a study from like 5 years ago, very small study, not randomized, not really, not the top-notch kind of scholarly study you want to see, but they'd say, look, it actually helps kids like it. It's good for them. It's good for them. Well, we now, the cumulative evidence is really kind of growing on the other side of that equation. So you need scholars to look at these questions, but you also need people who are coming at this, not just from a quantitative point of view, but a qualitative one. That's parents, that's religious leaders, that's people of faith who say, is this good for our families, good for our community? And asking those questions puts pressure on the research side and the public policy side to think about those things. Because I really believe, and I tell this to the high school students I teach technology ethics to, I say, the first question you should always ask when you open an app or look at a new platform, what's not on the menu? And I think, what have they designed away because they don't want you to think about it? And I think in our public policy and regulatory framework for a lot of these technologies, we forget to ask that question first. It should first be, what is not on the menu? What are we not asking here that we should be?
You've kind of hinted at it, but some of these issues are really controversial. As soon as you start talking about anything to do with pregnancy, you're going to get a whole host of different people starting yelling from both sides of the aisle. And sometimes for good reason, sometimes for bad reason. But in our daily lives, it can often feel like it's not worth it to kind of engage with these conversations, whether that be at colleges or universities or in your churches or at your, you know, places that you're involved with in civic life in general. So what advice do you have for people on engaging in these conversations in a way that produces useful fruit and isn't just spinning around the wheel?
It's a great question, because in a very polarized age where everybody sort of seems to have their instant talking points no matter what, it's usually based on how does my side want me to argue this rather than what do I feel or think myself as an independent minded person. Let's look at the fertility question, the sort of any issues surrounding pregnancy, around fertility industry, all this stuff. It's really difficult because these are very personal decisions people are making, right? A husband and wife who are struggling to have a family, they have a number of options. They have a lot of marketing aimed at them. They have a lot of social expectations based on what kind of community they come from. They also have restrictions that are, if they're people of faith, that their own religious community places on what is proper and what is allowed. So they're weighing all these things. So in some ways it's easier to just have the knee-jerk reactionary and very Manichaean, this is all bad, this is all good. the struggle here is that it's really always both, right? So I think if you're particularly on a college campus where you're concerned about whether saying something will get you in trouble, one of the ways to the best way I've found to talk to people about this is to ask them about their own experience. Like, do you know anyone who's ever used IVF? Do you know why they did it? Do you know what was their experience? Why did they come to that versus adoption or versus, you know, any of these other things? Get it. Almost everyone knows someone who's had an experience of regular pregnancy, fertility industry, aided, you know, assistive technology, adoption. All of these are ways that we've come to terms with creating families, but they're very personal. So I think if you ask people to talk about what they know from experience, then you can start saying, well, you know, was that a good experience? Well, is there something that might have protected, you know, you from a feeling of exploitation, or were you told all the risks of taking fertility medication? Do you know what they are? Because that's not discussed a lot. Because women who are desperate to have a baby will often, you know, go to any lengths possible because they don't want to think about long-term impact. Mm. So all of these are ways of, you know, if you think about how it impacts the individual, it's a good way to get into how public policy might or might not have room to aid us in the broader sense. And when I think about regulation of genetic technologies in particular, that almost, I've interviewed geneticists, I've interviewed, you know, members of religious groups like Dorya Shoram who use genetic testing to prevent horrible, always fatal illnesses like Tay-Sachs disease. And talking to them and hearing them speak about their parishioners and speak about their own experiences counseling families, it's very moving. And it's also a way to think about how some communities can self-police and will because they're very bounded. Mm. But for the rest of society, how do we translate that into providing those protections for everyone, even if they're not member of these bounded communities?
So you talked about this book at the beginning of the interview, but it's your book, Preaching Eugenics, Religious Leaders and the American Eugenics Movement. And I think your basic argument in the book is that as religious institutions modernized, as technology kept developing, they kind of abandoned some of the traditional religious tenets that kind of made the institutions what they were and ended up embracing, in many instances, eugenics. So how do religious institutions, churches, Christians of today avoid making those same mistakes as we see arguably even faster advancing technology today?
That's a great question. I mean, I would say if there was a through line with the historical evidence that I examined for the book, it was a lack of humility. And I say that not because as a character flaw for these groups, but what they did is set aside skepticism and humility because they felt and they really did believe that what they were embracing would improve people's lives. It would help them. And there was a real through line through the political progressive movement at the time that we need to, society is so complicated. Things are moving so fast. We have, this is the early 20th century, mind you, not today. There are a lot of echoes of how we hear these things discussed now. They said, it's too complicated to leave to people's judgment. We need experts. We need an expert class of highly educated people who know how this stuff works to explain it to us so that then we can embrace that, because, you know, who am I? I'm just a Congregationalist minister in Indiana. What do I know about, you know, whether or not the human race should be improved through better breeding? So I'm going to listen to this guy at Harvard who has a eugenics record office that's affiliated with these very fine institutions that I admire and respect. And you know, he's got a couple ministers on this panel that you know, they regularly talk about this stuff and they preach about it. There's actually a sermon contest that the eugenics organization, American Eugenics Society, sponsored a sermon contest, and ministers would give these sermons in their pulpits. This is among Protestants. What they had to set aside to get there was a healthy skepticism, and they had to move away from what the Bible taught them. I would say they the further they moved from kind of theology and into speculation and scientific mm-hmm. expertise, the more they lost their ethical moorings with regard to these technologies. So in the case of eugenics, they really wanted to improve people's lives without first asking the question, is this our job as leaders of faith communities? And if it is, should we be doing it at scale and lobbying for immigration legislation that keeps out my ancestors, Southern and Eastern European immigrants, or should we be tending to our own communities? They had questions about poverty and charity, right? This argument started to develop that, you know, throwing money at people who aren't going to improve just means they'll have more people like themselves. So actually, maybe we don't need to be giving charity. We need scientific charity is what they called it. And that involved a lot more coercion by the state. It involved a lot of meddling in people's, certainly in the reproductive choices. And that's how we got in this country, long before Nazi Germany passed these laws, we were passing sterilization laws in Indiana, in California, in New York, all across the country. States passed involuntary sterilization laws to stop the so-called feeble-minded, which was a scientific term at the time, from reproducing. And you don't get to that point while calling it a progressive improvement. That was considered a progressive improvement without abandoning skepticism, humility, and a true dedication to your faith. Yeah. Because faith, the first thing your faith should teach you is humility in the face of those sorts of, you know, promises of changing humanity, because it is ultimately not our job to do that. That, I mean, if you are part of a faith community, that is God's role. That is not human's role. Yeah. So that, I think, is what they had to abandon. And they did it because they feared losing parishioners who were leaving the churches. I mean, science was really challenging the cultural and social role of religion at the time, and they were fearful.
Yeah. I think it's fair to say that probably evolution had a pretty important role to play in kind of the onset of a lot of these issues. But what kind of practices of skepticism do you offer as advice to people sitting in churches to say, man, I'm listening to something that really doesn't strike right with me? How do they process that information and then move forward from there?
Well, the first thing is to search out other arguments, right? That's the first thing. And I don't mean go and join a QAnon chat board and start spinning conspiracy theories. That is not what I mean. What I mean is, you know, if your minister says something that you're like, I don't really know if that's a systemic problem, or I don't know if that's, I don't understand what that means. You read books on the subject. You find out who the experts are who are arguing something different. You listen to what they have to say and you weigh those options. At a certain point, you might, if depending on the kind of community you have, if you're a person of faith, you try to start a discussion. I spent a lot of time talking to small groups within religious communities. I spoke to one last night. They're Jewish parents who are concerned about educational trends, right? So I talked to them about social media. I've talked to Catholic groups and Protestant groups about aspects of technology. Again, small concern group. Form a group in your religious community with other people who are interested in debating these questions, discussing them, thinking about them in an open-minded way that allows for free expression. What you don't want to do is try to go up against, and every, unfortunately, human beings, we're tribal. And anytime, this is true in faith communities as well as non-faith communities, there will be sides, right? It's like, you have to agree with this because this is what we believe. Well, again, skepticism and humility are so important, and those are the values you should start with. You start with a healthy skepticism, a willingness to be offended, a willingness to listen to the other side, and to just keep questioning that. And a healthy communities allow for that. That's why I think social media is not a healthy form of community. It encourages other aspects of human nature that are much more dark. But in-person faith communities in particular are uniquely situated to allow for those kind of thriving and debates. Often they're very private too. You don't have to advertise them. You have a coffee meeting that meets like a book club, but you discuss ideas. I've been to many of these. They're fascinating. They're wonderful. I've learned so much just by listening to what those folks have to say.
Yeah. I would say that's kind of the reason I started, the people I work with started this podcast, is because we wanted to kind of open the door to those kinds of conversations that people weren't having. And conversations like this make that very interesting. So we really appreciate you coming on today. We like to give our guests the last 60 seconds of every episode to kind of share something that maybe they might not have had the opportunity to share, or to continue talking about something we moved on from. So the last 60 seconds are yours.
Oh, that's very nice. Thank you. I really appreciate you having me on. We've had a number of offline conversations about a lot of these things. I've always enjoyed them. I guess I would say to go back to what we talked about earlier about how technology changes what it means to be human. I would encourage your listeners to really think through in their daily lives what they've outsourced to technology and why. Is it for convenience? Is it out of fear? So we have a lot of surveillance technologies that we've kind of embraced and brought into our homes. Mm-hmm. How have we dissolved the border between the public and the private in ways that we might come to regret down the line. That Alexa speaker is really convenient, but it's also recording things that no technology company should have access to in the privacy of your home. We survey our neighbors now in a way that I think is can undermine community rather than build it. I mean, with platforms like Nextdoor and with, you know, home camera systems. And there's a whole way we're shifting our domestic surveillance that we're embracing. We're like, oh, we're choosing to do this. Makes me feel safer. But I think that the question we should start with all of these technologies is what are we responding to by embracing technology as the solution? And in this sense, I would say, and people laugh at me for saying this, but we should all be more Amish. And here's why. What they do, they are not Luddite. They are not against technology, but in each instance that a new technology is brought up as a possible intervention in their community, they ask a series of ethical questions about its impact on the individual, on the family, on privacy, on the community, on their religious practice. It's quite thorough. And it means that, you know, they don't have telephones and smartphones in their homes. They do use some of these technologies, depending on which Amish community you're talking about. They do have tools that are very useful, but they have deliberately chosen tools that technologies and tools that they can integrate into their community, not things that will disrupt their community and undermine its value. So that we need to do that whether we're Amish or not. And I think every new technology challenges us in that way.
Well, Dr. Rosen, thank you so much for joining us today. We really appreciate that. That was some wonderful advice. We really appreciate having you on today.
Thank you so much.
Thank you so much for joining us for this week's episode of the Cedar 60 podcast. We hope you'll join us next time as we continue to explore culture and politics from the distinctive lens of the gospel. Make sure to like and subscribe to this podcast and make sure to share it with your friends. And we hope you'll join us next time. Thanks so much.